If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Thursday, May the 9th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Hoover Institution's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Research Fellow. Our guest today here in Hoover's Washington, D.C. office is former Congresswoman Barbara Comstock. Barbara Comstock served two terms in Congress representing Virginia's 10th Congressional District, which is suburban Northern Virginia, not too far from the nation's capital. Prior to Congress, she served three terms in Richmond in the Virginia House of Delegates and was the only Republican elected inside the Beltway and the only woman in the Virginia Congressional Delegation during her tenure. Prior to elected office, Barbara was a senior partner at Blank Rome Government Relations, co-founded the public affairs firm Corallo Comstock, was a senior aide to Virginia Congressman Frank Wolf. I remember Frank Wolf from the 70s and 80s. I thought he would never leave Congress, actually. She also served as chief counsel on the House Government Reform Committee and was head of research and strategy at the Republican National Committee. She's the founder of the Young Women's Leadership Program for young women in high school and junior high, which will now be housed at the Barbara Comstock Institute for Women in Leadership at George Mason University's Schar School of Public and Government. Research and strategy is a nice way of saying opposition research, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So I have to ask you this question. If you're doing opposition research for Ed Gillespie, how do you not find Ralph Northam's yearbook?
Well, that was the RGA that did that. So, yes.
What we're referring to is the Virginia's governor's race.
And the blackface pictures.
And the blackface picture.
And certainly everyone regrets that.
Right.
And we still have a governor who, in 1984, at the same time that Doug Wilder was making his first race for lieutenant governor, he was in the state senate at that time. So this, you know, 1984, Virginia wasn't some backward place. We had Doug Wilder was about to be elected lieutenant governor, the first African American lieutenant governor, and he ended up being the first African American governor in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So what Ralph Northam represents is not Virginia and not what we have right now. But interestingly enough, you know, just as recently as last year, he was running around talking about his moral authority. And then his attorney general also had that same blackface problem. And our lieutenant governor has had two accusations, two very credible accusations of rape. And they're all there, and the press has left the building, and nobody is hunting them down anymore.
That's my question, and I want to turn this into a What's Wrong in Richmond, Virginia podcast. But these are people, you know, the governor is accused, he's caught wearing blackface. But the lieutenant governor accused of something very, very serious and something very, very awful. But they're still in office. So what does that tell us about the culture we're in? Does that just mean that if you just ride out the storm, you can ride out most anything? Or,
well, I think that is what they've decided. Mm-hmm. I know that's what – I guess that's what the men can do. I don't know if the women would be given that kind of leeway. But they did hunker down. But I think the press has also given them a pass, as well as given a lot of the state Democrats a pass, because the the women involved are politically active women who made these accusations against the lieutenant governor, Justin Fairfax, and they wanted to come before the state legislature in some manner, and the Democrats just refused to do it, and they said, well, we want bipartisan, you know, hearings, and by the Democrats just saying, nope, we won't do it, and standing back on it, they're now not going forward, and the press just isn't asking them. I can tell you if the shoe were on the other foot, I could and would not have been able to get out my door every morning without having a camera crew there asking me, what do you think of this? And when are you, you know, why aren't you stopping this?
You worked on a House Oversight Committee in the 1990s. That meant that a Republican-controlled House was investigating a Democratic president.
Yes.
Now, the role's reversed. It's a Democratic House investigating a Republican president. As you watch this unfold, as you watch the House go into Donald Trump and the issue of executive privilege, what is in bounds and out of bounds with this president? Let's start, for example, with taxes.
Well, in the past, presidents always, recent presidents
release
have turned out their tax
records.
Turned their tax records. But Donald Trump said during the election he just wasn't going to do it. It's not legally required. We hadn't passed a law to require that, so he decided not to. Now, I could tell you, when we did investigations, while Clinton had already turned over his tax returns in the course of the election, when we were doing investigations of other people, we didn't go after, say, some of these people who are making illegal contributions. We didn't go after their tax records because we did feel that would be a bit Nixonian to go after the tax records, and that that should be something that would more be in the Justice Department realm if when there were investigations going on, not congressional. So we didn't go after that. Now, granted, you know, Clinton had already turned his over, but we had a lot of other people who had financial malfeasance, things that we were looking at that we didn't go after their taxes.
Right. Where did that committee, where did you draw the line in terms of going after Bill Clinton? Remember, Clinton famously phrases the politics of personal destruction. Clinton was a very inviting target when it came to embarrassing him personally. So where did you draw the line in terms of not going after Bill Clinton?
Well, the investigations we had done were in the areas of, you know, he had fired the White House Travel Office, which were career federal employees. And
right. Give it over to friends. Right.
Yeah, and when that started, Frank Wolf, who was my predecessor, was really just offending six or seven federal employees who had been wrongfully dismissed who came to him and asked for help. And that's how that investigation began. And then it turned out they had been wrongfully fired. Congress actually gave them, one of them that was wrongfully prosecuted, money to make him whole and to kind of make up for a wrongful prosecution. Then we did the campaign finance investigation, which was, at that time, I know it doesn't sound like a lot, but $6 million of illegal foreign money, largely from like China and Thailand and areas over there, you know, in over the Pacific. And that money was illegal. It ended up, the DNC had to return it. And Janet Reno, who was attorney general then, did prosecute a lot of those people who were engaged in that. So there were actual, you know, crimes involved there that we worked on. I was, the impeachment and all that was over at the Judiciary Committee. I was on the Government Reform Committee, which is the committee of late and recently that people have seen Michael Cohen at.
Okay. These Trump investigations, especially on the House side, what's your sense as to where it's going? I can give you three avenues to go down. One is, this is Speaker Pelosi's way of letting them get their yayas out. That is, they so hate this man that they just have to vent their steam. And so they let them vent the steam by investigating him. The second road would be that you keep him pinned down by investigating him. It keeps him preoccupied. It makes him mad. It tweets. It keeps him off message, deranges him, if you will. And then the third one is you investigate him to the point where you can come up with an article and you impeach him. So what's your hunch as to where they're going?
I think all three are open right now. Mm-hmm. I think they've decided they want to keep him occupied on doing this.
Right.
And, you know, and I will say maybe some difference between the 90s and now is, you know, in the New York Times, it said we needed to investigate campaign finance. I think, you know, this has all been completed, the Mueller investigation, and he has looked at all of these things in the Russia area and did not come up with, you know, prosecutable crimes there, or really there's not any more to investigate because he's looked at all of it. But I think they want to keep that active, and they're going to continue because their base is demanding that. And you can see that with the presidential candidates also calling for it. But there is, I think, a significant group of them that want impeachment. Mm-hmm. So is that going to be where they ultimately go? I think we've seen that with Donald Trump, if he has someone to fight against. And I think, interestingly, I think Trump looked back at the Clinton years and saw, as Clinton was investigated and he fought against the what was perceived at the time wrongful investigation, oddly enough, one of the people who said it was an unfair investigation during impeachment was Donald Trump himself, didn't think that Bill Clinton should be investigated on the Monica Lewinsky things. And I think he looked at that and saw that Clinton benefited from being able to push back on a Republican Congress. And I think he has taken that lesson to heart and looks at this as an opportunity to push back at them. I'm concerned it does take us off, I mean, as really over the past 2 years, we were not talking about what has been a good economy and the tax cuts that we passed that are doing a lot of good things. And, you know, the president does talk about that, you know, a fair amount. But there's far too much, you know, on the other side of things. And that just gets everybody just sick of this, the fighting. I think there's a lot of people who just kind of want that to stop. And it would be better if we were telling them about the great economy and that you have businesses that are expanding their paid family leave because we provided tax incentives for that, mm-hmm. that you have a $2,000 child tax credit now, that you have investments that are going forward at a great rate, that wages of lower income people are actually increasing for the first time in years. And so there's a great story to tell on the economy that the press doesn't want to cover, and the Democrats certainly don't want to cover. And I don't think the president should cooperate with the press and the Democrats by moving the discussion always over to these investigations instead of trying to move it more over to the economy.
Do you miss being in Congress?
Since Republicans are in the minority mm-hmm. right now, I had the privilege for the past decade of serving in the majority, both in the State House and in Congress, where I was able to get a lot of legislation done. Right. And actually, in my last term, last 2 years I was there, I was named one of the top 10 most effective legislators. So I enjoyed that very much. It was a huge privilege. But having served in the minority as a staffer, I know how little you can actually get done. And I like being a legislator. And I've been in Harvard over the past semester. And when the kids talk about it, I said, well, when you go to Congress, you can either decide you want to be a legislator or a congressional Kardashian. And there's a lot of people who like to be a celebrity.
Right.
And they like to go on TV all the time. And they don't get anything done. And I said, on the one side, you have like Beto O'Rourke, big celebrity, right?
Right.
Never passed a bill in Congress. And he was there longer than I was. And I was able to pass, you know, quite a few bills on things, you know, STEM education, the tax, getting some things in the tax bill, firefighter grants, right. Some gang legislation, some, you know, and a number of other bills and a lot of bills when I was in the State House. But these people who just want to go and be on TV, I said, on the other side, you got like Louis Gohmert, who never passes bills, but just likes to rail and be on TV.
Right.
So I think when you're in the House in the minority, it's sort of a time where you don't get to do legislating. And that's really why I was there. So right. I was happy that all through October and then even in the lame duck session after, I was able to get a lot of the things done that I wanted to get done. And I think I've learned over my career that I can work on a lot of the issues I care about no matter what seat I'm in. So mm-hmm. I've been a staffer, I've been in the administration at the Justice Department, worked in the private sector, which I'm back doing again, and now teaching. And I'm able to do things like help veterans, work on human trafficking. I passed legislation there. I'm also continuing my Young Women's Leadership Program mm-hmm. at George Mason that I started 6 years ago when I was in the State House. So fortunately, I get to do a lot of the same things. And having been in Congress gives you a certainly good insight and a platform to continue to do all the good parts of the job.
Let's talk about what happened in 2018. Mm-hmm. You read articles about your campaign and your loss, and you tend to get lumped in the same category as Mimi Walters from California, Mia Love from Utah, three women legislators who were very good at their jobs, good fits for the districts, but they got taken out, and the person who's blamed for this is Donald Trump. Is it that simple? Was it a Trump effect?
It was. I mean, there was 40 of right. us. I mean, Mike Kaufman in Colorado, Carlos Curbelo in Florida.
Right.
When the president's numbers were well over 50, they were 55 mm-hmm. or more negative in my district at the time of the election. And that was, you know, I had won by 6 points the year he won by, he lost by 10 in my district.
Right. Hillary carried it by 10 in 2016, but you won.
By six.
So you
said I had more votes right. than Hillary and Tim Kaine in my district in 16.
So simple question. What happens between 2016 and 2018? What alienates those voters?
I think it was very similar to, say, 1994 with Bill Clinton mm-hmm. and 2006 when the Democrats, and then again 2010 reacting to Obama, is that's the way people see to react to the president and have a check on him. And they wanted that check. But then look what happened in 96, you know, I mean, Bill Clinton had the check, he came back. In 2010, Obama had the check. I mean, I actually was elected to the State House in 2009, so I was the beginning of that check on Obama
right.
in the State House. So I think we are a country that likes to be balanced, mm-hmm. not go to one extreme or the other.
Right.
But the thing that happens when they do that check is they take out the middle.
Right.
And so they take out those of us who are in those swing districts. And in the case of last year for Republicans, it was, as you mentioned, right. a number of the women. And we went from having 23 women down to 13.
Down to 13.
And so now it is only 6.5% of the Republican caucus.
Right. So you were trying to explain these in very nuanced terms to your constituents, it seems to me. You did not endorse Trump in 2016, right?
No, but I did. Here's the thing. The president's policies are about 10 points more popular right. in these swing districts right. than he is personally. And so it's not that they dislike tax cuts or dislike the opioid bills that we passed
right.
or dislike the regulations that we put in place so that make the economy boom. They like all of that. It was the tone right. and how the president, you know, presents himself in those right. districts that just riled up people.
Right. You tried to explain that Trump policies were basically Romney policy and McCain policy.
Yeah, they know. Yeah. yeah, I mean, and we were. I mean, the tax. You know, right. the first time in 30 years to have tax reform, mm-hmm. to be able with a because these policies were. There was a New York Times chart that they had all through the thing. You voted with Trump 97.8% of the time, or whatever the number was. Well, what that was you know, tax cuts. That was 7 votes to keep the government open, which. Guilty. I did that. Right. I thought we should keep the government open. It was opioid legislation. It was things like right to try legislation, which, you know, a lot of these things, I'll give the president credit. He moved things
right.
that hadn't been moved, like right to try legislation, which says if there's drugs available and you're, you know, sick and there's nothing else there and you're kind of terminal, you get to try things that may not have gone all through the FDA process. So there are good policies there. And unfortunately, in the swing districts, president's tone and certainly some of the things on immigration, which I think probably are unfairly, you know, the tone doesn't help.
Right.
But even on the immigration policies, the immigration bill that the president actually endorsed, which was the Carlos Curbelo's bill that I voted for, was something that I think if you went through and just asked mainstream Democrats and Republicans, do you support this? It had a DACA solution. It had money for the wall. So you're reforming the immigration system while you're also taking care of the DACA situation, but we're going to have control over our borders. That's something that is a center-right and a center-left position that I think the Democrats didn't want to give that win to the president because then they couldn't scream and yell about him, you know, being unfair to immigrants. And I think for those of us who really wanted to have immigration reform, people like Carlos Curbelo, who worked on it hard, he ended up kind of paying for that in his election, even though the president would have signed his bill if the Democrats had let it go through. So a lot of unfair things there, but it's the dynamics. The country wants to have us more in the center, I think.
Yeah.
I think so. I think it's center-right. I think tax cuts, strong national security, strong defense, all of those things are still very much supported. So I don't think there's been a big swing to the left, and I don't think we'll see socialism prevail in any way.
Yeah, I don't see a Bernie button. I don't see an AOC button on your box. So.
I am still very much a Republican and never voted for a tax increase. Very active on the tax cut fronts and having a very strong national security. And so I do give the president credit for all that. So I said, listen, when the president's right, I'm going to be for him. And that's why my voting record was for a lot of these good policies that the House and the Senate passed and put in front of the president. You know, these weren't the president's bills often. They were our bills that we shaped and had worked on for years. Signed them. I mean, some of these bills were Democrat, and my bills, almost all of them were bipartisan, and most of the bills on that Trump list of bills, I think something like 80% of them were bipartisan. So there's been so much misrepresentation in the press, mm-hmm. but I think sometimes the president likes to goad that anyway. So, but I think for the president, it works. You know, I mean, I think he goads them. They take the bait. They make it all about him. He likes that. The press likes that. Democrat fundraisers like that. So it kind of works for all of them. It just didn't work for those of us in the swing district.
The point to make, and unfortunately the Washington Post will never cover it this way for you, is that there's a world difference between supporting 97.9% of what the president wants to put his signature on versus supporting 97.9% of his tweets.
And I think that is a very good way to put it.
So AOC, I'm sure as a former member of the House, you watch her with a lot of interest, probably thinking, my goodness, I could not have gotten away with this kind of behavior myself.
Yeah, she's one of those Kardashian types. Yeah, likes to be a celebrity.
She is, and I'd love to ask the question to people. I think this is a great parlor question. Who's going to be in Washington longer, Donald Trump or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez?
Well, I guess as Nancy Pelosi famously said, you know, a glass of water could get elected in her district with a D next to the name.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be a matter whether her district is a district that wants to get anything done and maybe get legislation. I mean, I don't think you'll see any of her bills pass.
Right.
The same for, you know, Ilhan Omar. Mm-hmm. I don't think she passed any bills when she was in the state house.
Right.
It was interesting, you have some of my male Democrat colleagues, Jerry Connolly, who's here locally in Virginia, he said about Ilhan Omar, but, you know, it's kind of the same approach. Well, she's very young and doesn't really know, you know, what she's saying. So, well, no, she's a mother. She's 37 years old. She's been a state legislator. She is a grown-up.
Exactly.
And she is responsible for what she says and does. And for him to infantilize her and, okay, oh, she's just a little girl. Mm-hmm. You know, it's strange that that's okay for the Democrats to do that to their women. Of course, you know, they when I was in there, they were, you know, similar. You know, they tend to have those kind of sexist remarks too. So it's interesting. You find a lot of this misogyny on the Democrat side that's usually ignored by the press.
So she is one of 89 women now serving in the House Democratic representatives, and there are only 13, as you mentioned, on the Republican side. Why are Republicans not doing a better job of getting women to office? Are there not that many women running, or is this just women being in tough districts, or do women just not want to run as Republicans? Because this ties into another question I want to get into with you, what one has to endure as a woman, a Republican woman, what you have to dispel, what you have to push off, just the various challenges to you and your femininity.
Well, you know, back in the early 80s when I came to town to go to law school, there were more Republican women in Congress than Democrats. Oh. Now we have, and there's only been something like 320-something women in Congress in our entire history. So what's close to 11,000 members of Congress, House and Senate, and only 320-something have been women. And right now, over a third of those are currently there. The year I was elected, it was the first time we went over 100 women in Congress. So there, it is now, though, the Democrats have about 38-39% of their conference caucus is women. On our side, it's 6.5%. So we did get, last year, we were the first to be targeted. I mean, the Democrats do tend to target our women and our minorities because if you're a woman, you're supposed to be a Democrat.
Right.
If you're Hispanic or an African American, you know, my colleagues, you know, Carlos Corbello, Will Hurd, you know, they get attacked like that too,
right,
as well as Mia Love, double threat, right? She's an African American woman. You know, they didn't even want her to join the Black Caucus when she went to join. So you definitely have a tougher road to hoe when you're a woman on the Republican side. But it also, I was always running in a blue area, blue delegate seat when I was in the state house, and blue district, essentially, you know, except for my predecessor, it had often gone. It went 1 point to Romney.
Right.
By 1 point, Trump lost it by 10. You know, most of the other Republicans who had run recently had did not win it, you know, in the governor's race and things like that. So it was always been a tough area. So, but I think our ideas are still very strong in the suburbs long term. I mean, I think this is a time, not just here in the country, but all around the world, where you see in France, you see in Germany, you see Brexit and everything Theresa May is dealing with, where we're going through a time where everyone's trying to adjust to how do we, in a time of prosperity and a growing economy, and but a lot of disruption in that economy, how do we adjust to that?
Right.
And it's a big challenge. And I think the president is trying to address that in a lot of ways, differently than say than I would. I was a Marco Rubio Republican, so I think. But then look at what they're doing with Venezuela. You know, Marco has been was one of the first people out there on the Venezuela issue, as well as Rick Scott from Florida, and the president has been very strong on that. So I think you have different leaders and how they talk about it and how they get to the same place, and how do we get those policies? I've gotten a little off our topic of women, but I think Nikki Haley did a good job with all those things too. But I think the challenge is that we are targeted by the Democrats in a way that the men aren't. And I think they're very comfortable. But now I think Republican women, now you're seeing them this year do kind of what Democrats did last year. Mm-hmm. They're not waiting to be asked to the prom. They're not going to wait for permission to run. They're going to jump in and say, well, listen, we've lost all these seats.
Right.
How could we do worse? Why don't we get in, particularly in the red seats? Because there are 31 seats that Donald Trump won that are now in Democrat hands. Now, only 13 of those are seats that the president got over 50 points. So those 13 are your most promising prospects. Then you, to get the numbers you need to find a few others where you can get some really good candidates. And I think if you look for women, say small business women, people are in the state house, people who've had some governing experience,
right,
who have that kind of background. I mean, I know in California, Young Kim, who had a very close race in California, is going to run again. She was a fabulous candidate, you know, mm-hmm. Korean American woman who been in the state house and just has a great resume, but also very much in touch with her district, who would be a far better representative for that community. And I know the party is very invested in her. And because of the sharp contrast now, I mean, when you do pictures of our conference, mm-hmm. Republican conference, it's a lot of white men with white hair,
right,
and only a few women. So I think the men and the women are now wanting to look for women candidates, because we are not going to be in the majority again until we get more women, because you know, the numbers aren't there to get us to a majority without having more women candidates.
So how do you recruit more women, especially to run as Republicans? Because it strikes me with women, there are two issues. One is a general career issue. This law firm might be the best analogy for this, where you're a woman, you're in a law firm, you're an associate, and maybe you're on a path to partner, but you have to balance this with family and other interests. And sometimes law firms are reluctant to hire women for this very reason. They think, well, she's not going to be here 5 years from now, so why do this? But so one is trying to encourage women at what point in their life to get in. But then secondly, if you're going to run as a woman, because back to what I asked earlier, what you're going to have to endure. You ran once and your opponent said you never had had a job, right?
Yes. Yes, and actually, I did want to mention, since I'm at a law firm right now, I'm at one of the most family-friendly, women-friendly law firms, and we have women in our leadership, and that Baker Donaldson, who's Howard Baker's firm, that's why mm-hmm. I chose it, because it is very forward-leaning on having women in leadership roles. So I think that can be replicated
in
Congress, and they are rated, you know, one of the top two places. I mean, only one of two law firms in the top 100 places to work.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have more, and they do it naturally. They do it, you know, it's not quotas, but it's something they're very conscious of, and they know it adds to the bottom line. And I think that's how our Republicans are seeing that more, that it's, if we want to get to the majority, you have to look more like America. We have to be more diverse, and not in the way that Democrats often do, by quotas or whatever. And let's face it, the Democrats aren't going to hand over all their seats to women, because some of the guys still want to run on their side. You know, they now are almost at 40% there. So if we ever want to be parity in Congress, say 50-50 or get close to that, it has to come from having more Republican women. And I think that's a good thing. I know in my case, my husband's a teacher, so I was a primary breadwinner in my family. So taking time out of my career wasn't something I could really do to run, even though I had been in government and done that. I had never really thought about that, because I didn't, when I had to put the kids through college and we had to make that extra money, I didn't think I was going to be able to take a $17,000 job in the state house, which is what I ended up running for when I ran for office. What I didn't really realize or appreciate is I could work still, because it's a part-time legislature. Mm-hmm. So at that time, I had my own business and was a consultant at that time, and I could run. So I think a lot of it is trying to get women to understand how you fit public right. service into your life in different ways, whether it's your local school board or heading up your Chamber of Commerce or heading up your Rotary Club, and then when the opportunity might come, whether it's when your kids are grown or if you're single and you can do it,
right.
how you can take that service and get them to run. So I think a lot of it is just putting more examples of women running in front of them and telling that story. I'm working with a number of different business groups as well as a number of different political groups just to sit down and talk to women and tell them why they could be candidates and why they should think about running and why we would be better for having them.
So point me to a woman office holder right now who embodies this, who really gets this, and who young women could look at as a good example of what you want to be one day.
Well, I think there are a couple. Let's see, Elise Stefanik, who is the youngest woman elected at the time when she was elected in 2014 in my class. She's fabulous, and she has a PAC now where she is working to get more women elected. And Elise is, you know, had worked in a small business. She worked at the White House, and you know, she's on the Armed Services Committee now, and is just a good legislator. She really does her homework, and now and she is working hard to not only recruit women but to help them in the primaries so we get them through in those red district primaries, in any district where they might want to run. Ann Wagner, who I had worked with at the RNC, who was party chairman, she was a ambassador. She has now been in Congress since, I think, about 2012. She's in a leadership role on the Financial Services Committee. She's from Missouri. She is a great role model and example of sort of a business-friendly woman who's had a variety of experiences, you know, been an ambassador, you know, worked in business. And she is, you know, exactly the kind of woman we need to see, you know, moving into leadership ranks. And then Martha McSally in the Senate is just wonderful. And, you know, I would oftentimes when we would go around and do events together, a lot of the women, we would do fundraisers together, and I would read her resume. You know, she was, you know, first in her class in a number of classes that she was in, first female fighter pilot, all these superlatives. And when I read it, I said, you know, if you were a guy, they'd be asking you to run for president already. That's how incredible and impressive her record is. So, and then I think Nikki Haley has been a great role model. You know, she was a state legislator. She's a great example of a woman who didn't wait to be asked to run. Mm-hmm. When she decided to run for governor, she was in the state house. It wasn't sort of her turn. And she decided, no, I want to run for governor. And she did. And then, you know, got reelected governor of South Carolina, and then was picked, you know, for her, you know, and she had endorsed Marco Rubio in the right. primaries, but was selected as UN ambassador, and I think did a wonderful job, and now is heading up her own group here, and I think very well could be our first female president.
She was on Ben Shapiro's podcast last weekend, and yeah, it's pretty clear she's not going away.
Not at all. Yeah. Not at all. So I think, and we have more. I know I'm forgetting, I'm not, but I think those are some good examples. I think you'll see Mia Love get back engaged again. And Young Kim, that I mentioned, I think she's a great leader. And I know in the State House, I'm working on a number of races, helping some women in the State House now who are stepping up to run. And their backgrounds, you know, I think they watch the Democrats and saw all these Democrat women come and they're saying, well, I've got more background than that. I've done a lot more things than bartended.
Right.
Although, nothing wrong with bartending. I was a cocktail waitress. So that's a good experience for people to have, too. Just probably good to have some other experience on top of that.
Speaking of people who'd like to be the first woman president, Kirsten Gillibrand, the New York senator, is running for president. And she has, from the get-go, made her campaign very clear that she wants to be the Me Too candidate in the field, that she wants to appeal to those people who turned out and protested at the Trump inaugural and show up in the pussy hats and all that. You also look at the polls, and she's at 1% or 0% in most polls. So what does that say about that message right now? I don't want to get you into trouble here and suggest that it's not an important message, but it seems like the moment, if it hasn't passed, it seems like maybe it's peaked.
Well, I do think the first female president will be a Republican.
Why?
And I think
why is that?
Because I think there's quite a bit of misogyny on the Democrat side. And isn't it interesting that the Democrats, their two top candidates, are 70-year-old white men right now? and that the women, none of the women candidates are getting a lot of traction. But I wouldn't attribute it to the Me Too things, because I would not, while I think the Democrats and certainly women and men try and make that partisan, mm-hmm. we saw with the public figures, political and Hollywood and TV news, the figures who dropped, it was bipartisan. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what party Matt Lauer is, but I never saw him at any right-wing conspiracy events. But, you know, we had Roger Ailes, we had Charlie Rose. There was John Conyers, Al Franken, and then we also had our Republicans, Blake Farenthold and others. So it was very, you know, misogyny and sexual predators are, you know, come in from both parties and actually and mostly men. And I think one of the really good stories that was not told last year, and I know certainly, you know, we couldn't kind of get, you know, the difficulty because of the, you know, all the dynamics going on, but we passed great legislation to battle sexual harassment. I mean, I worked with Bradley Byrne, who hopefully will be our next senator from Alabama. Great guy. He had been a labor lawyer. He sat down with Jackie Speier, very liberal Democrat from California.
I live right next to her district.
There you go. But she had worked on this issue a long time. When we sat down with her, and I think Debbie Dingell and others joined us, we went through all the things we wanted in sexual harassment prevention legislation, mm-hmm. and we agreed on all of them. It was nonpartisan, and we got it passed. And everyone said, you're never going to pass it. People will try and stop it. It did take longer than we would have liked. It got finally, that some of the bigger legislation got passed in the lame duck. But we also, one of the things that had not been done until just last year was making it, not allowing members to date their own staff. You know, you can't do that. You can't, you know, in the private sector, like at a law firm, you cannot be like a managing partner.
Or a professor dating a teacher.
Exactly. In the private sector, this has been the case for years. And that's what Bradley said. He goes, I was kicking out corporate executives and people who saying you cannot do this. And if you do, you're out. Yet Congress still was having this policy where it wasn't against any of the policies. So that was my legislation to say, that's against policy. You can't do it. Not allowed. You can't pay for, you know, because I wasn't allowed to hire my husband and have him paid on the payroll. You can't have you either date someone on the outside, but you don't bring them in. Right. And so that was made, that was finally made the law just last year. I mean, that's how far behind Congress was. So I know people like Senator Gillibrand and others try and make that issue a partisan issue. And it is not, I mean, she came and campaigned against me. And I was like, hey, I passed more aggressive legislation than you did. Well, I'm the one who got it done.
Well, her campaign interests me because she, from the beginning of her campaign, she has just made anger, women's anger against Donald Trump, the core of her campaign. But it hasn't gone anywhere. Now, granted, she is a very flawed candidate. She's flipped on a lot of important issues, abortion and guns and so forth. But she's tried to make that the Me Too, Harvey Weinstein-fueled anger at the core of that campaign, but here we are now in 2019, and she may be gone by December of this year. So the issue just hasn't resonated for some reason.
Yeah. Well, I think because she was trying to use it in a partisan way instead of a genuine way, and because she herself had been a beneficiary of Bill Clinton and then only attacked him
threw him under the bus.
So I think,
and she drove Al Franken out of the
Senate. Yeah, and that kind of hypocrisy on it, yeah. I think people are like, well, you're just using this as a partisan issue, not as something you're genuinely trying to do something. And I think because I think a number of these women candidates don't really seem to have policies that they want to run on, but also their side is, you know, they like to always think that it's Republicans who are against the women, but look, they have just a harder time to rise up in the ranks often as women on the Republican side. It's just like last year, they were running against Trump. They weren't running against us.
Right.
Now they have to run on their own, and look at all their guys who want to move them out of the picture. I mean, you look at Beto O'Rourke. He's done nothing. I mean, he's just a celebrity candidate. He's gotten, I mean, in his entire life, what is he? He was on a city council where he got nothing done, married a wealthy woman, came from a wealthy family, married a wealthier woman. If that were a woman who had been in a city council, married a rich guy, done nothing in Congress, what would your picture be? So in fairness to Kirsten Gillibrand, maybe she's done a little bit more than Beto O'Rourke, who's probably higher in the polls, which what does that tell you about the Democrats, that they may rank a Beto O'Rourke higher than a Kirsten Gillibrand or a Kamala Harris or even, you know, I mean, Amy Klobuchar actually has passed legislation.
Right.
You know, she's gotten some things done there and while she's been in the Senate.
But with Klobuchar, very interesting, once the moment she announces for president, stories come out of nowhere about what a awful person she is to work for. So this gets back into the challenge of being a woman in politics, that you, and especially for Republicans, you get lumped into very specific categories as a Republican. You're either a shrew or you're a stepford wife, which I imagine your opponent was getting at, saying, oh, Barbara Comstock's never had a job. She's just a big nothing. Or you're submissive. You're meek. You just go along with what the men tell you. And it seems to me, again, maybe I'm being unfair to the press, but show me the last time the Washington Post wrote a really flattering column about you or a Republican woman. It just, the only time they do it is when a Republican woman breaks with Republican orthodoxy.
Yes, well, after my election last year, I did get an outreach from the Washington Post, like, hey, we'd like you to write something for us.
Yeah, you know? Want you to play the victim card.
And so they also want you to attack Republicans.
Right,
now,
right.
I've been public in disagreeing with the president on policies like shutting down the government or, you know, some of his statements that he made. You know, I worked with everybody in my district. So, you know, when I didn't like the, but I did that. When I didn't like something that Paul Ryan was doing, who's my friend.
Right.
So I think that's how mature people should be engaged in politics. You should be able to disagree with people in your own party as well as people opposite and still come together and get good policies done, which is what we did, whether it was on tax cuts or regulation or, you know, one of the first bills the president signed was my STEM bill. So you can, you know, but the press made it, like, if you said anything against the president, then they wanted to rile it up to then get people in your base mad that you've disagreed with the president.
Right.
I mean, Lindsey Graham has disagreed with the president on things. You know, everybody has. But sometimes when the women disagreed, then they get mad, like, oh, you're not going, you know, you're not agreeing. I said, well, I'm my own person. Interestingly, the press, I would just say, I'm my own person. I have my own issues in my own district and concerns that I have. And I will sit down and work with anybody, including the president, to get things done for my district. Terry McAuliffe was governor when I was in the state house, and he signed my bills. I had investigated him back when he was, you know, fundraising and all the illegal money was going into the DNC. So I can work with someone like that. I can work with whoever is going to sign good policy. And if you want to be a legislator, that's what you have to do.
Right.
Now, if you just want to go on TV and bash people, then, but you're right, they don't want to let women kind of have their own voice. And that's been one of the things that I think the press, and I think the president actually plays the press on this. The president understands the press wants to get ratings and get clicks.
Right.
So that's why he gives them the tweets, and that's why he distracts them with it. And in a way, a lot of the policies that were passed over the past 2 years, you know, things that we got, you know, drilling in Alaska was in the tax bill.
Mm-hmm.
Hardly anyone knew that because the press was always chasing after the tweets. Now, I happen to think that's a good policy, but for the 40 years before that, that was always something that there would be uproars and there would be press. So it's interesting. I don't think the press realizes that a lot of these good policies, whether it's regulations or things, they don't even know it's going on because they're following the latest tweet. So there is some genius to that
right.
The president does, that it allows legislators and our agency people to do good policies that are getting done. Look at the great work Mitch McConnell is doing in getting good conservatives through the appointment process and getting them on the bench. So I think, you know, I would give credit to the whole team. I mean, certainly good nominees that the president has put forward and then the Senate and Mitch McConnell for getting them through. But for women, the press is very, particularly for Republican women, they're focused on making you answer for anything that the president said at any given moment. Even, and then if you don't disagree with that, then they'll attack you for supporting a policy. And in contrast, you know, we started out by talking about the problems in Virginia. Mm-hmm. The three women who were elected in Virginia are not asked every day the way I was about, well, how can you defend women and how can you vote for this when you're allowing someone who's an alleged double rapist there and you aren't even supporting these women being able to come forward and you aren't demanding that these Democrat women who are in the state house sit down and have hearings and allow them to come forward. How can you support your party doing that? Those would be the kind of questions that if the press were in any way even-handed, would be asking them every day. They'd be saying, how can you tolerate somebody in blackface? Because this is going to be three more years that these guys are all in office till 2021. You know, so it's incredible that this is just being ignored, and the press is definitely a collaborator on that, as they were collaborators to just take the Democrat. I mean, we would literally, my press secretary would get a question from the press, which you could almost just read off of the Democrat Congressional Campaign Committee's website verbatim. They didn't even do their own homework. We would just, the press release would go out, we'd get the question in. You could just line them up and say, wow, you guys. Now, that does not happen when the Republican committees hand out questions. You've got to ask them this.
Right.
They do not dutifully go and ask those questions.
Exactly. Final question. I sure appreciate the time you've given me today. Mm-hmm. You get a call from the Trump campaign. The president calls you and says, you know, I've been looking at the numbers. I've got problems with women in this election. And what you've talked about, the president's strategy, yeah, it's, you know, it's entertaining, the press loves it, and it's great for his base, but it's not a strategy for growing the party necessarily, and we'll see if it's a winning strategy in 2020. But if he were to come to you, his campaign come to you and say, what do I need to do to talk to women voters? What is a winning message for me? What's your advice?
Well, I think you do have to have more women, you know, not just family members or women are around you. That's why I think Nikki Haley was such a strong, good voice for Republican women, but also for the administration.
So more cabinet members,
so more women, higher people who are in visible roles, mm-hmm. who are out there talking about the economy, talking about the you know, public safety issues that are important to women, and that's national security issues. Again, that's, you know, Nikki was certainly very helpful on that front. But also, you know, at the Justice Department, and I know they've tried to get people. And one of the difficulties when you're in a partisan environment like this, and when you have Democrats just want to yank everyone up there, who wants to go up there right now? Who wants to be in that type of situation? But I think telling our story of the economy and opportunity, and, you know, women's unemployment, how we've improved that, opportunities for women. But really make an effort. I think probably it would be, let's start endorsing women and let's let women have their own voice. That doesn't mean they have to agree with you on everything, because as Ronald Reagan famously said, my 80% friend is not my 20% enemy. And I think, and I have to say, I mean, I was at the White House on gang issues at one time, and the president started talking about shutting down the government. And I spoke up and said, Mr. President, we do not need a government shutdown. And I think, you know, the press, oh my goodness, you said that to the president. The president, you know, I didn't get tweeted at. I didn't get attacked. I spoke up and I said what I thought was right. And I think, and the president didn't shut down the government at that point. It happened in the next term. So I think people, you know, allowing women and, you know, any Republican to step up. I think you saw Joni Ernst step up and say, you know what, I'm not going to support Steve Moore. And I think, you know, I give the credit to the president for respecting that and having both Steve and Herman Cain, you know, decide not to go forward. I don't think that's, because I don't think it's helpful to put people forward with those backgrounds to reinforce the stereotype that the Democrats are trying to put in place. You don't need to give them actual hard good evidence of that stereotype. You know, I'm sure there are some women you could put on the Federal Reserve Board, and how about doing that?
Okay. Are you volunteering?
No, I think there are probably women with great backgrounds from the Treasury Department. I'll think of a few who would probably be well placed there.
Very good. Congresswoman Comstock, I enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us, and tell your friends about us. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover's fellows straight to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. Barbara Comstock is on Twitter, yes?
Yes.
Boy, you're brave. Her Twitter handle is, not surprisingly, @BarbaraComstock. I will spell it out for you, BarbaraComstock, @BarbaraComstock. Anything else you'd like me to plug for you?
George Mason, because we're going to be sending out information shortly on our George Mason Young Women's Leadership Program for the summer. So for the past 6 years, we've had junior high and high school girls come and see the diverse group of women leaders in our area in Northern Virginia and learn from them in all different fields. And those are exactly the kind of women that would be, it's a nonpartisan program, but when you'd asked what the president might be able to do, we have a diverse group of women in Northern Virginia, and tapping into that type of diversity is a great thing to do.
And that is George Mason University Schar School of Public and Government, Public Policy and Government, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Thank you.
They can find that. SCHR, Schar School of Policy and Government. Run again. We need you back in Congress.
I'm enjoying things now, but thank you.
Okay. Well, take care, and thanks for coming in again. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.